Good afternoon, or morning, yep, it's morning. So today is exam review, since the last class. Try to prepare you for the final, maybe, or make sure you know to prepare for the final. First, some anonymous feedback notes. So some people apparently don't like the VM homework, which, by the way, is due tonight at midnight. And some people thought we prepared you for it. Seems to be more people who are frustrated, but that's usually what provokes people to make anonymous feedback. We obviously think that we gave you the information to do it. And there's some a lot of people, more than I expected, who were confused by that we gave the physical page number in the page table based register in the homework and not a physical address. And I've learned over teaching that putting something in italics is not enough for people to read it. Probably putting things in bold italics also not enough for people to read it. Or people didn't understand it, which would be a problem with us teaching how to divide addresses, which maybe we'll go over today. But just say we're aware of that. We're not going to make excuses for how good or bad we taught virtual memory, especially since I didn't do it. So with that out of the way, let's talk a bit about logistics for the final. So the final's on the schedule. It's May 9th. That's a week. In a week, 7 p.m. It's in Gilmore Hall 130. That's the big lecture hall in Gilmore Hall. So don't try to come to this room. You won't find the final. It's the same final time for both sections of 30-30. That's why we're in a combined time. And it's 3 hours, so about twice a midterm. We hope that it won't take almost all of you 3 hours, but we'll give you 3 hours. Question? No. Okay. And the final format. So basically, our basic philosophy for making the final is that we're going to, yeah?
I don't think there's a Gilmore Hall at UVA. Or did you mean Gilmer, the...
Yes, I mean Gilmer.
Okay, all right. Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
Yes. That is me. Yep. Yeah. This is what happens when I use something which corrects my spelling all the time to search for where the building is. So Gilmer Hall. Yes, okay. Gilmer Hall, which I need to make a note to update. So I'll make this Gilmer Hall, and I will have this right in the PM lecture. So. So that it's basically a midterm and a cumulative final stapled together. So most of the content will be from after the last midterm, but we'll have some cumulative questions. And therefore about twice the length of a normal midterm and a very similar format to the midterms you've seen before. So you shouldn't be surprised by the types of questions we ask and how you have to write them. Questions about format? So it's basically a normal length midterm and a cumulative final that's the same length as a normal midterm stapled together. I won't guarantee exact lengths, but we'll do approximately that split. Okay, and so for most of this class, I'm just going to go over questions you might have. If you don't have any questions, it will be a short class. But to remind you of things that might be somewhere on the final, this is not an exhaustive list. This is me just going through the schedule and looking at what are the major topics we've covered. So we talked about x64 assembly, things like loops, addressing modes. We talked about C, arrays versus pointers, undefined behavior, lists and such. We talked about ISAs, RISC versus CISC. And we had Y86-64 as our example ISA, and we talked a lot about how that was encoded. And we had our sequential processor, which you all built, so should be very familiar with, so you should be able to ask you questions about. And HCL2D, which is how you built it. Yes?
The previous exams, like from past years, they're the same length and like format as
So the question is, on exam format, are previous exams indicative of the sort of exam you should expect? Generally, yes. Okay. So we talked about HTLTD, and we talked about pipelining, including sort of general pipelining trade-offs, what our division of five stages was, and also about pipelining hazards, which is the main source of frustration on our pipelining assignments. We talked a bit about how modern CPUs work, which we might ask you about out-of-order processors and the data flow model. And then for the last part of the class, we talked about caching, performance, including cache performance, sort of cache optimizations like loop orders and cache blocking, and other types of optimizations, which hopefully you implemented at least one of for those homeworks. And we talked about processes and exceptions and virtual memory, which should be fresher in your mind. Okay, so that's my summary list of topics I think we've covered. I mean, anything we've actually talked about is fair game, and I might be missing some things we spent a little bit of time on. This is sort of the broad things you probably want to know. So with that, let me take your questions. Yeah?
There was this question that asked about whether if we have 100% usage of the virtual addressing space, whether or not a hierarchical memory structure versus a single level, single level structure was.
Okay, so space used by change tables, e.g. 100% of virtual addresses occupied, okay?
My specific question was that at 100% occupied, does hierarchical memory take more space or just equal space?
We'll answer that. I'm going to collect questions and then answer them all together so you can answer related questions at the same time so I don't draw the same diagram multiple times. Yeah. Okay, cache locality and loops. Okay. Other, yeah.
What's an ISA?
ISA, what? Doesn't definition? Okay. Other topics I should, yeah.
For the first performance lab, can you explain why switching the order of the loops made a difference?
Loop order in the in rotate, sure. Yeah. Context switching, okay. Other topics I should talk about? I'll maybe ask again later, but I'd like to have talk about related things together. Okay, so we'll just go through these. So first on space used by page tables. So how do you figure out how much space is used by page tables? And first thing I'm going to do is actually switch to the screen I want to. So in a page table, we have our single level page table, we have that is off the screen, a page table base pointer. And we have a bunch of page table entries. And let me make it so I can actually use this pen. Okay, that would probably be less awkward. Base pointer. And we have a bunch of page table entries here. So, and each of these, so we have a page table entry here. And this takes up some amount of space. So, for example, it might be 4 bytes. So with a single level page table, the number of page table entries we have is 1 per virtual page number that's possible. So for every possible virtual page number, we need to have 1 page table entry with a single level page table. So let's take an example. So let's say we have 4-byte page table entries and 32-bit addresses. So how much space is this going to take up then? How do we figure that out? Am I missing any information? The page size. So I need to know the page size. So we need some sort of page size. So let's say it's 4 KB. So what we're going to want to figure out is how many pages do we have, virtual pages do we have in total? Or how big is our virtual address? So if we take our 32-bit address, we're going to take that and we're going to split it into a page offset, which is just like our cache block offset, except we're talking about location in a page. And with a 40 kilobyte size from our powers of 2, that's 2 to the 12th, so this is 12 bits. And the rest, the remaining 20 bits, is our VPN. And that means that there are 2 to the 20, in this case, page table entries. And so that implies that we need to have 2 to the 22 bytes for this single level page table. And this is regardless of how many of these entries are actually valid. Because it doesn't, in a single level page table, it doesn't matter which entry here is, whether you have a 0 for a valid bit, which is also called present, or the negation of on disk, or 1, we still need a whole page table entry for every single page. So it doesn't matter how much of the address space we're using, it always uses the same amount of space. Yeah?
How did you get 2 to the 22?
Because 4 is 2 to the second, and we multiply the size of each page table entry times the number of page table entries we need. So with a multi-level page table, we're going to have varying sizes. So we'll have our page table base pointer again. And we'll have a first level page table, which will possibly point to various second level page tables. And the format and this is similar in that we still have our page table entry with at least a valid bit and the actual pointer, but instead of going to a page, it goes to another page table. Typically by the physical page number where the page table is. So we have our second level, and we have multiple second level page tables. But notably in this case, if we aren't using some big block of memory, if we have some amount of memory which is unused, it doesn't need to have second level page tables. That we just say it's invalid in the first level page table, and we don't allocate a second level page table for it. So to figure out how big this is, whether how much we've actually saved, or whether we've actually saved anything, we want to know how big is this first level page table. And that's going to depend on how we divide this address. So one way we could divide this address into pieces is we could just divide, we need to choose a place to divide this overall VPN into one for the first level page table and one for the second. So one thing we could do is we could have 10 and 10. We could do some other division, like we could do 11 and 9 or something like that, but 10 and 10 simplest. So we'll have VPN for the first level and VPN for the second level. And I put the first level first, so addresses which are close in memory have the same second level page table. This way we cannot allocate an address if we have a big region, allocate a second level page table with a big region of unused address space. If we should put it the other way, we wouldn't be able to do that. So in this case, we have, again, 4-byte PTEs by our assumption, and we have 10 bits here, so we have 2 to the 10 times 4 bytes, or 2 to the 12 bytes. That's for our first level. For our second level, we have the same size because we also have 10 here. So in this case, we have 2 to the 10 times 4 bytes is 2 to the 12 bytes for per second level table. So our total space used is 2 to the 12 bytes for the first level plus the number of second level tables times 2 to the 12 bytes. This is the total space we need for our page tables. So the question is, how many second level tables do we need? So in the quiz question, we had all of our virtual address space allocated. So in order to do that, how many second level tables do we need? Yeah, so we need one for everything. So we need 2 to the 10th. We need one for each of these entries would need to point to a valid second level table. So in our quiz question, we're going to end up doing 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 12. So for all, this is 2 to the 12 plus 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 12, which is greater than 2 to the 22nd, because this is 2 to the 22nd already. And so that's why it takes up more space. But if we could omit a bunch of these second level page tables, so let's say we only need 2 of them, which would happen if we have 2 pages allocated that are far apart, and that's it. Or we have a bunch of pages together in 2 areas. We could have that. So if we only need 2, then we'll have 2 to the 12 plus 2 times 2 to the 12, which is 3 times 2 to the 12, which is not that big. And that's where we save space, where we don't use that much of our virtual address space. We actually don't store all this extra information, which we had to for a single level page table. Yeah?
So at 100% capacity, hierarchical memory, the hierarchical structure for page tables takes up more space than
Yes, so at 100% capacity, we take up more space. So in the limit, if you're using everything, you might as well use this simpler table structure, because you're not going to be wasting space with all these 0 entries here. Like, you won't have any of those entries to worry about. But with this case, if we have this unused space here, that if we had a flat table, we just have this giant swath of identical 0 entries, and that's what we're avoiding. If you don't have that, you're not going to actually save anything. You're going to have a little extra space to deal with the interaction we have added to potentially avoid storing this redundant information. So, questions about this? Okay. Apologies for my, yeah.
So, different implementations change the proportion between VPN 1
and VPN 2
to increase
Yeah, so there might be changes with different implementations for how this address is split. Notably, sometimes you can't split it up evenly anyways. So you might have page offset, and maybe this is 21. And if that's 21, you're going to need to make an inconvenient choice. That you're going to have some weird page table. Yeah?
So the example that we have, just a single page table, our address, we had it as basically 2012 split 32-bit address.
Yeah.
I'm just comparing this back to the memory assignment, where I don't know if it's different. For me, the multi-page one actually got longer. It was an extra 2 bytes.
Yeah, so this is
those are just different implementations.
Those are just different cases. We hypothetically support 2 virtual address sizes in our machine in the memory assignment. For one, you'd need to use single level. You could use single level. For the other, you couldn't with the page tables they implemented. Yeah.
Where did 2 to the 10 come
from? Here?
Top,
yeah, here. So, sorry, you can't actually see my cursor. So here, this 2 to the 10?
Yeah.
So that's because we have 10 bits here.
How did you know that you needed to split it up into 2 and 1?
So I chose arbitrarily. So the platform decides how we split it up, because we could have just 1 level, in which case we don't split it up. We could have 2 like this. We could split it up into more than 2 levels. You have to be told. So in our memory assignment, we tell you in that text that probably most people don't read that every page table is exactly the size, and you split up things into multiple levels if that doesn't work. And that's how you're supposed to know. You're supposed to know because every page table is only, in the case of the memory assignment, only 16 entries, So you can't. So you know how many how big each part of the split is from that. But you have to be told because you can make other choices. We could have divided it up into four levels, like 5 bits each or something like that, and that would be perfectly valid. It happens that, so the reason I chose these numbers is because it happens that 2 to the 10, that this is the size of a page, which is a nice, very convenient. And often you'll see when real architectures choose their page table sizes, they'll do it so it ends up that parts of the page table are exactly the size of a page when that's possible to do. Okay. Other questions about this sort of virtual memory stuff? I'm sure people are still confused, but I guess we'll find out later. Okay, so that was space used by page tables. So next on cache locality, yeah.
I'm not sure if this helps to add anything to block things off, but could we also go over data flow?
Data flow? Okay.
I don't think that fits under any of the categories, but.
Yeah, that will go later. Okay, so cache locality and loops. So I'll do this with text because this probably is better with text. So with a loop over I, J. So one question is, so if we're accessing array I, this is good, and I'll do, and this is repeatedly access array, same place. And we know that because so I changes less frequently, and J changes more frequently. And that means temporal locality. So what you look at is you say, I look at the loops, how often do these variables change? So the ones which change less frequently, that's where you're going to see temporal locality, where you're accessing the exact same thing over and over again. So if the array index is changing not very frequently, either because it's like an outer loop variable or it depends on them in some way where it's just not going to change from iteration to iteration of the innermost loop, then you have temporal locality. You're accessing the same thing over and over again, and if they're not cache hit, something is wrong. So our other case is we do something like array J. So here, we're accessing consecutive locations. If you think about this loop, we're accessing array 0, then array 1, then array 2, then array 3 on consecutive iterations. So these are right next to each other, so we have good spatial locality. And you can apply the versus this case, we're accessing on the first several iterations, we're accessing array 0, array 0, array 0, array 0, array 0. So that's why we have temporal locality. And you can go through this analysis for something more complicated. So if you see array I plus j, you can work through what is that access on the first several iterations, or in the middle of the loop. And on the first several iterations, that's array 0, array 0, array 0, array 1, array 2, array 3. So that looks like spatial locality. So you just say, first time we go through any of those loops, we access array 0, because I is 0, j is 0, then we access array 1, I is 0, j is 1, and so on. And so the way I would go about reasoning about this is try to figure out what these sequences of access look like as we go through the loop, and say, are these things that are next to each other? Are these things that are the same thing over and over again? And that's going to tell you if it looks like you have temporal and spatial locality. And you might see examples which are sort of poor in both. So like if you do there's some case, I guess that's probably a bit more complicated than we'd like. Like if you do array I times j plus 1,000, you see that like this is array 0, array 1,000, array 2,000, and so on. And that seems to be bad locality in every respect. So is this what people were looking for on this? I guess we often ask when you change the loop order what happens. In that case, we've just changed what the sequence is for the innermost loop, which is the one which matters. So array I here now does array 0, array 1, array 2, array 3. And there's similar changes to the other things that you might be doing in there, because we've changed the order in which the loops happen. So we changed whether it was the j loop which really mattered or the I loop which really mattered. Yeah?
So for the array alpha j, as that loop goes on, the spatial alpha would get worse and worse, right?
For array what?
For the array I plus j, the one I'm talking about.
For here?
Yeah.
As the loop goes on, that would get worse and worse?
Yeah.
The spatial locality?
Yeah.
No, they'll always be next to the thing you just previously accessed. With the exception of, so when we transition from iterations of the J loop, we're going to have something like array N, then array 0, but then we're going to do, then array 1, I should say, then array 2, then array 3. So we'll have this moment of bad spatial locality, but overall our spatial locality will still be good. So then next I. So we'll do, we'll get to n from j equals n or n minus 1, and then we'll go to the next I, and we'll have this bad spatial locality, but then we'll still have good spatial locality, overall. We'll have these exceptions where we jump around all of a sudden, but overall, we'll still have good spatial locality. So I guess the caveat with analyzing these is that sometimes you have to think about these loops a bit. So in some cases, so if we have something like this, in this case, so what about this example? So you probably wouldn't ask this on a test because it's a little ambiguous. But for this case, it's tempting to only look at the K loop, but you probably shouldn't do that because it has 4 iterations. So probably it's going, so our pattern is going to be 0, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. So you can say that it has temporal locality and spatial locality. Because the K loop is small enough that we have multiple iterations by the time it start matters in the cache. Because it's not something big like N, it's something small. So we have multiple iterations that can get locality between each other. Yeah.
Would you have to know the size of the cache for that?
So you'd have to know some. So for this example, you'd have to know something about the size of the cache to say definitely whether it matters. You could say whether it's better or worse than something else, though.
So in this case, what would the size of the cache have to be?
I mean, it has to store at least 4 elements of array for it to get useful temporal locality, which pretty much any cache can do.
Would that be 4 or 8? Because you'd have to.
4, because we just want to use 1 again. Actually, 3 is probably enough. So pretty much any realistic cache will benefit from this. Yeah?
Whenever we see a 0 to 3, we should always think of unrolling it to make it faster.
So in practice, you would consider unrolling this. Whether that actually makes it faster will vary, because as we said, there's a trade-off to unrolling. But yeah, you would often consider it because it's a very good candidate for that. Yeah.
How exactly will the different speed up processes be covered on the exam? Will we be given a block to say rewrite this code to make it faster, or?
So the question is, what format of performance questions will we ask? Asking you to rewrite code is inadvisable for a lot of reasons, mostly because I don't know how we grade that. And it's not very nice to give you a performance assignment where you can't measure performance. But we might ask you whether, we'll certainly ask you questions like whether X or Y version of something has better spatial locality or should be faster given a certain kind of processor. Like, you definitely should know whether things are faster or slower on the pipeline processor, and you should know in general whether things are likely to be faster or slower on an out-of-order processor based on sort of our data flow idea, or could be faster, at least.
What would make something faster on the pipeline versus?
So we'll switch over to data flow. So our notion, the notion of data flow, I guess I should just do, no, that's not how I do this. I probably should just use this slide. So the big thing to remember about data flow is that we have, is that what out-of-order processors are essentially doing is that they find the operations they can do right now, like produce this sort of chart from your code at runtime. And they find the operations they can do right now and do them in parallel if they have parallel operations. So the big thing to look for is, are there multiple things I can do at the same time given this code? And that's the big question you should have when looking at performance. So multiple accumulators was one big thing we did, where you're worrying about, do I have dependencies? So here, in this case, we have multiple accumulators, so we can do two adds at once. If we didn't have multiple accumulators, they'd all be dependent. We couldn't draw this diagram in this way. And that's the big thing where out-of-order processors will have a benefit. So we'll ask about whether something could be faster because you could do things in parallel that you couldn't do otherwise. And that's what you should think about when you're thinking about, can you get better performance from this? And one thing you should be able to reason about is, how many things can I do in parallel given how fast like the adder is? If we tell you how fast the adder is, how often it accepts inputs, you'll be able to figure out what's the most I can put in with this program. Like, can I saturate it or can I not? Okay, so data flow, so it's, reduce sort of dependency graph of program. Key is parallel if there are no dependencies to stop that from happening. So if an operation depends on another, can't do it in parallel, even if it's indirect. You need the values, dependencies, time, and enough functional units. So if you have enough functional units, so you actually have the capacity to do the computation.
Like enough adders or something like that?
So like enough adders or enough, and often functional units, e.g. you might have, you might be able to do two adds a cycle, or something like that, two adders, or one multiply, every three cycles was one of our examples with, cycle with three cycle latency was another example. So often it will be the case that maybe you only have one multiplier, but it's pipelined, so you can start a new multiply every three cycles, but you don't get the result until then, so you need to take that into account. And you can just draw sort of what's the timeline look like for this. So if we have we start multiply one, so we do one, and you can do then in order to take advantage of this, you need to have three multiplies that don't need the results of the others. So, for example, if we have, we're doing something like, A times B times C times D, then this multiply one could be
A times B. And this can be C times D, but this multiply 3 we can't use, because we need the result of A times B or and C times D to do the remaining multiply we have to do. People seem maybe puzzled by that. And you should be able to reason about that. And I, if you wonder what's going on, this is the sort of thing I recommend figuring out. Like, what, when do we do each multiply? Yeah.
You can start the mul 3 until after the last mul 2.
Yeah. Because we need to wait for the result of the mul 2. So even though we could fit a multiply there, we can't use that. Yeah. I'll ask at the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we start the mul 3 in the same cycle as the mul 2? Like, can it just pass that value down, or do we have to actually start in the next cycle?
So this will vary. We'll generally say that you can. We'll generally assume in our questions that there's no sort of forwarding latency. Mm-hmm. That when the result of the multiply is available, you can use it immediately. We'll tell you if that's not true. On real processors, this does vary.
Okay. So in that case, we could start the multiply, the third multiply, in the same cycle as mul 2 or not?
So when could we start the third multiply, we can't. So with this assumption, we issue one every cycle, so we can only start one a cycle, which is just how our multiplier works, and you'd be told that.
But if three multipliers depend on mul 1 and 2,
so the earliest we could start is we could start here. So we could do a mult here, which would be the final multiply. That would be the earliest we could start it, because it has to be after 2 finishes. Because we need the answer for 2. And that means that this takes a total of 7 cycles. Okay. Any other questions about data flow? Okay, so ISAs, what does it mean? So the expansion of the acronym is instruction set architecture. It is, what do the instructions do, and how are the instructions encoded? So these are the things which are in the ISA. So the things which aren't in the ISA is how the instructions are implemented, how fast the instructions are. So the instruction set is the functional part of how you use the processor. It's not anything about how it's implemented. So we had both, for example, a single cycle and pipeline implementation of Y86, the same instruction set architecture, even though the speed of the instructions is very different. And if we had a out of order processor implementing it, it would still be the same instruction set, even though the implementation would look very different. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, is it possible for a processor to adhere to an ISA and then add more functionality on top of that and still claim to be implementing this set?
So the question is, what do we call it when we add onto an ISA, add instructions? Like, do we still say it's implementing the same instruction set architecture? I would say that there's disagreement about this sort of terminology. So typically we say that if you implement an ISA and some extra stuff, that you're still implementing that ISA. So we still say everything is an x86 processor that's compatible with the 486, even if they implement other things in addition. Even though we'd say that the ISA, the full ISA they implement is something bigger than the 486 ISA. So those things they're adding are part of the ISA they implement, but we might also say that, you know, less instructions than they implement is still an ISA they implement. Yeah?
So why would number of registers be a part of the ISA?
Because this is, what do the instructions do is they read and write a register, and how they're encoded certainly depends on the number of registers. So it's the, you know, everything functional about what instructions do. So this includes number of registers, instructions might change. So if there's a register you can change, you have to define whether that's possible or not. So that needs to be part of it. Like, because it's the instruction encoding, we need to know how many registers there are and whether, which ones of those register numbers are valid. That's part of the instruction encoding.
Isn't that more like implementation than like what they actually do,
what the instruction does? So the idea here is that this is the visible aspects of the instruction. As a user, you can tell how many registers you can use. So it is true that processors might want to have different numbers of registers, but to do that, they can't change the number of registers you think you have without changing the ISA. So we briefly mentioned, we won't test you on probably, with out of order processors, like have extra registers, but they do that without exposing them to you. So they don't change the ISA. They use extra registers in secret. And similarly, we could make a processor which has less registers for real and like accesses memory instead. That would be also valid. But the key thing is that it's number of registers, you know, visible to instructions, as you say. Because that's part of what instructions can do, right? And part of how they're encoded. We need to fix that number. So it's not going to be necessarily the same as the number of registers in the hardware. We might have more, we might have less. We'll typically have a few extras, like in your pipeline processor, you have a whole bunch of extra registers which don't have names in the instruction set architecture. And that's perfectly fine. Okay, other questions about ISAs? Okay, so loop order and rotate. I probably should have done this, I'll move this up to here. So loop order and rotate. So in rotate, the loop that we provided you was something like 10, and was, I believe, dest I times n plus j equals source j times n plus I. It was something like this. And this has bad locality in source, good locality in dest. And it turns out that that locality in reads was more important than for writes. That our test machine, that locality for reads was more important than for writes. And this is probably because of how the caches were implemented. My guess as to why is because writes can be done sort of in parallel in the background. So the processor has this big queue of writes. It can do them without pausing instructions, but it can't do that for reads. So you can issue a write, and it tracks those writes, and it doesn't stop your program from continuing to get values while it waits for that write to finish. Yeah?
Is there any way, other than just testing it on the machine, putting in code, and seeing how the machine responds to it, is there a way to figure that out, like which locality is more important, other than just certain guesses like you did?
There's not a great way. So Intel does have a manual for an optimization manual, which might tell you this as a piece of advice. And otherwise, you could read what Intel has to say about how their cache works. And that probably actually gives you enough to figure this out. But it's like it's a description of like how they do writes in the cache. It's not a simple thing. You could, if you knew how the cache works, you could figure this out. And it's probably an artifact of how the cache handles reads versus writes. Um, I guess the other part of I've done in parallel. Also, L1 is probably right through. So the L1 cache is probably right through to the L2. So you don't actually have real misses. So the most common thing to do on a modern processor for write through write back is that all but the last level of cache is usually write through. It's not always what they do, but that's the most common policy for reasons that have to do with multiple cores. Yeah.
Why would write through reading is more important than write?
So this means that that to do a write, we can just do a write of less than a block. Whereas if it was write back, we might need to bring in the block, or we might end up bringing in the block for some reason. In which case, we'd have to write out a whole block despite not changing a whole block. So we change one part of a block with the write back policy. We'd bring that block into the cache sometimes, if it's write allocate at least. And then we'd change the one thing we changed in the block, and then write out the whole block later on when it got evicted. And that's going to be slower than writing out just the little piece we're changing. Write through, it's probably, I'm not sure, so can do writes of less than the block. So even if it's less than the block, since it's probably not write allocate. Well, even if it is write allocate, we can do writes of less than the block because we know what we just wrote. Yeah. The reason why L1 would probably be write through to L2 is, and it's not necessarily, I'm not sure whether it is, but there are advantages with respect to how to handle multiple cores to doing that, which we will not discuss in this class because we discuss how we make caches work for multiple cores, but it is easier to make caches work for multiple cores with the sort of organization I'm mentioning. So other topics. Context switching. And I believe I have a slide for this. So sort of our picture of what a context switch looks like is that we're running some user process, then some OS code runs, and then we're running a different process. And that's what it appears to the user, that some process is running on the CPU, then some other process is running, and then we're back to the other process later on, maybe. And each of those changes is a context switch. So the operating system runs some code, which changes what program is running. And to do that, it needs to move the context. And our context is basically all register values, condition codes, program counter, basically all visible state in the CPU, except for memory itself, because that's handled by updating our page table based register. So that's what we're actually changing. So our context switch does something kind of like this, that in the operating system, we store the PC from before the exception happened and all the registers and some data structure. Then we load all the registers from the other program and jump to the PC that we saved. This is sort of the pseudocode of what a context switch looks like. Now, you basically just copy all the registers to somewhere to save it for the process we're switching away from, and copy them back from where we saved them previously for the process we're switching to. And, you know, so conceptually, we just switch from that we have in the CPU, we either have, we switch from having A's, registers, and including pointers to memory, and as we've learned, actually, including the page table base register as part of this in the CPU, to having B's. Yeah?
If you're running on a processor that's pipelined, do you have to also save all of the pipeline registers as well?
So the question is, if we're running on a processor that's pipelined, do we have to save all the pipeline registers? The answer is no. When we get an exception, the processor is going to save this, is going to stop the program after an instruction cleanly. This is that precise exceptions thing. It also applies to pipelining. So when we have an exception in the pipeline processor, we're going to stop at a particular instruction and not let any other instructions complete.
Basically, you pause the program counter that all the functions that are still in the pipeline finish.
So you choose a location in your pipeline, and you let all the instructions before that started before that instruction finish, and then you bubble all the other instructions. You squash all the other instructions. So just like branch prediction, when we're running an instruction which might have an exception, we're actually executing it speculatively. We don't actually know that it's safe yet. So if we're doing like a load, it might be the case that we find out, oops, this load accesses memory that's not supposed to be accessed. And it shouldn't actually happen. And also the instructions we started after the load shouldn't happen. So that is part of precise exception. So I guess I will say exceptions, pipeline state. So stop. So stop after a particular instruction, never expose partially finished instructions. So we never ever give the appearance of partially finished instructions. Sort of, and the usual mechanism is squash/bubble after exception. Is that any instructions in the pipeline afterwards, we set the bubble signal or otherwise squash them. This is a little more complicated for things which might be like in the executor memory stage. Not an implementation detail we didn't go over, but that's what we do to make sure that the exceptions happen after a particular instruction finishes from the view of the OS, even if our processor is not implemented quite that way. This is an example of what precise exceptions mean. So if we needed to save the state of the pipeline registers, that would be imprecise exceptions. That's the classic example. And there were real systems which did that, where they told the OS, oh, you had an exception, here are all the pipeline registers, good luck. But that was not very useful. So context switching, which is register, program registers, RAX, RSP, etc. So yeah, context switching, you save the context, the page table base register, condition codes. So this is all visible state in the CPU. From CPU. Which is just copy, in restoring the context, is just copying from an OS data structure to CPU registers. That's basically all the OS is actually doing. Yeah?
Since technically any memory read could possibly close an exception, does that mean you have to stall and execute?
So the question is to do the squashing, you're wondering?
Yeah.
So processors will have a more sophisticated mechanism to handle the squashing. So we didn't talk about this with YAD664, but what are we worried about if we have something like, so if our pipeline is going to be, we have a memory read, which was just fetch the code, execute memory write back. And let's say that this is false in memory. And we have an add queue afterwards, which is not it, which doesn't stall because it's not dependent on the memory load. This is a memory read, not dependent, and a sub queue that starts afterwards. So what are we worried about here?
If you have precise exceptions, even though the add isn't relevant, shouldn't it still stop?
So we just need to make the so fault. Then this is squashed. So we need to hide it. So as long as it didn't change anything, we're fine. So the question is, what could have it changed? So so it can't have changed registers, sort of program registers, because no write back yet. Can't have changed memory, no matter what instruction it is, because no memory yet. Could be changing condition codes, but can stop. So we just need to stop it from changing the condition codes because we detected something in the memory stage.
Okay, so we can transfer that signal midway through execution? Before
assuming we're detecting the exception before the memory stage finishes, yeah. We could do that. That would be one way. So if you couldn't do that, there are other implementation strategies. The simplest thing is you would have two copies of the condition codes. And you could restore the old copy. You could, like, have a copy of the condition codes from the previous instruction just in case an exception happens. There are other, so we can handle it. So you need to do extra work to handle it. This is also squashed, and this is an easier case. Yeah.
We have some topics.
Absolutely. So other topics I should cover? Yeah.
So physical versus virtual cache, and virtual index physically tagged caches.
Okay. Okay. Other topics missing? Yeah.
Page directories.
Okay. So physical versus virtual caches. So I believe have. So our basic idea for, so the big trick we want to do, that I'll start with the virtually indexed, physically tagged to give our big trick. Our big trick is that we want to make the way we look things up in the cache and in page tables to have this nice coincidence that the page offset, the part that doesn't matter for the page table lookup, is exactly the thing we need to do the first part of our cache lookup. So we want our cache index and cache offset to overlap with that page offset and nothing else. We don't want to do the page table lookup to depend on, to be related to how we figure out the sets of the cache we care about. So we're going to get our sets from the cache based on just the page offset. And the page offset doesn't change between the virtual and physical address. And that means that we can do the lookup of the set, we can use this offset to get this set from the cache without worrying about what the physical page number is or the virtual page number. We don't care what it is in the cache at that yet. So after we've done that set lookup, then we do care about whether the cache is storing physical addresses or virtual addresses. And it's going to almost always be more convenient, I'll go to that later, to store physical addresses. So that means after we do the lookup, then we care about whether we have the correct physical or virtual address, because we have a part of the address that we care about that changes based on whether it's physical or virtual. And that we're going to use to compare the cache tag. So this is the happy coincidence we want. And this lets us start our cache lookup with any type of address, no matter whether the cache actually stores physical or virtual addresses, and only need the actual translated address, if it stores physical addresses, at the end, when we do the tag check. And this is what allows modern processors to have a TLB and usually not slow down loads. So I guess I... So the virtually indexed physically tagged idea is the cache index plus offset is only in page offset. Same set looked up with virtual or physical address. This means can store only physical addresses in the cache, but still start the lookup with a virtual, or physical address. But we still need the physical address to check the cache tag. So we look up, start the lookup, this is equals read this set of the cache. So that's sort of the virtually indexed physically tagged trick. Yeah.
So previously we didn't check the cache tag. Like, how is this different?
So we still check the cache tag. So if we were doing, so if we have physically indexed, physically tagged, the cache X plus offset may overlap with physical page number. Can't look up the cache set without getting part of the physical page number. So this was our problem before, is that we wanted to look up our cache set and I guess we'll do this. That we want to, is that we have a, here we are, okay. Is that we have our sort of index offset, tag index offset versus our something like PPN and page offset, something like this. And in order to look up the index, we have this region here, I guess. That overlaps with the index in our physical page number. So we need the physical page number to do the lookup. Even though in our, so we can't do the lookup with our virtual address. Because this part here, this is not the same as the physical page number. So it's not the thing we want to look up in the cache. Does this make sense? No? So this is where you run into problems. So if our cache worked out like this, where there was a difference between, now there's a difference between using the physical address versus the virtual address. Yeah.
So I'm still a little shady on this right now. Is it possible for you to go through an example of how we read this whole tag index offset rather than doing our what we knew for the PPN offset? Is the process any different?
What do you mean, read the tag?
So like when we actually parse through and look up like this is the page number, this is the virtual page number, to actually do that mapping that we did for the homework. Is it any different? Is that process any different now that you introduce this?
No,
index?
The process is completely the same.
Okay.
So the difference is that we might, is that we'll do, is that we get sort of cache set, is that we take our, is that what we want to do is we want to take our page offset, get the, go to the cache and get cache sets with tags. And then, and also do our VPN to the page table and get our PPN. And now do the check tags operation. Whereas this is what we want to do. This is the virtually indexed, virtually indexed physically tag trick, because we can use any type of page offset. They're always the same. But what we'd have to do otherwise is we'd have to take our VPN, go through our VPN and our page offset, go through and get our PPN, and then take part of this and go to the cache, and then get our cache set with tags, and then do our comparison here to check the tags. So this is what we're doing, is we're doing these two things in parallel. Where previously, with the other arrangement where the PPN overlaps with the index, we can't do that because we can't look up the sets without going through the page table first. The page table lookup is exactly the same, except hopefully it's a TLB lookup in every single case we're doing this. Almost every single case. So questions about this arrangement? Okay, so the other half of this question was, so this is about virtually indexed physically tagged, which is the main concept. So the versus physically indexed. So the condition here is that index plus offset bits are less in size than page offset size bits. So we know that the index part is part of the page offset only. It isn't part of the physical page number, so we don't have to look up the physical page number to get through that first part of the cache lookup. So above options assume physical addresses in cache, which is almost all processors do this. That conceptually the cache stores physical addresses. So we might start to look up with part of the virtual address, but that's only because it's the same as the physical address in that part. So there's an alternate implementation where we put virtual addresses in the cache. This has some disadvantages and some advantages. So the advantage is that we can use any cache organization do the cache lookup without a page table lookup, and that we can avoid TLB lookups. Without page TLB / page table lookup, I should say. Avoid TLB lookups in most cases. And maybe use a fancier, slower TLB instead of what we normally use. The disadvantages we have the synonym problem, which is that two virtual addresses could be same physical. Virtual addresses are different in different programs, so invalidate the cache. So typically systems which implement this on a context switch, they'd invalidate this cache to handle that would be one of the solution. Another solution is you need to add or process numbers in cache tags. You need to add information to the cache tags to handle that, but you need to do something to deal with that different virtual addresses are different in different programs. There's also, what happens when page table changes. It's less clear how to deal with that in these systems, but you have to invalidate part of the cache and have a mechanism to do that. Yeah?
Could you clarify very quickly the functionality of the TLB again?
So the question is, what does the TLB do? So TLB is a cache for page table entries. So normal caches take an address, conceptually take, an address, a byte address, an address, and return and map it to contents of address. TOBs take a physical page number, sorry, a virtual page number, and map it to the page table entry for that virtual page number. So the thing we look up in the cache in the TLB is the virtual page number. We don't try to, we don't assume there's, generally TLBs do not assume there's spatial locality in pages. So there's almost always blocks of one PTE. Like, I think pretty much always blocks of one PTE. So there's no offset bits. And these are generally set associative. So index bits, which is lower bits of VP virtual page number. So there's index bits in this cache, and the tag. Tag is rest of the PTE. Virtual page number, because this is mapping virtual page numbers, not address, not physical addresses, virtual page numbers to page table entries. You don't get the contents of the page. You get a page table entry. That's a common confusion, so I'll size that. Okay. And page directories. So page directories are Intel's name for non-last level page tables in their multi-level page tables. That's all they are. So they're page tables that, so page tables that point to page tables instead of physical pages that store program data. We will try to, you will generally use the terminology like kth level page table. You won't use Intel's terminology, but you should know it exists because you might end up reading like an Intel manual. Yeah?
So what's the difference between hardware managed and software managed?
Okay, hardware managed versus software managed. So hardware managed, hardware does the page table lookup and fills the TLB on demand. In software managed, OS does the page table lookup, which means there's an exception which happens to a fault, and runs a special instruction to add to the TLB. So almost all current systems have the hardware approach, where the hardware actually does look up in the page table and fills up the TLB. But a significant number of systems have done the software approach, where they trigger a fault when something isn't in the TLB, and have the OS do the page table lookup instead of the hardware actually doing like the task you do in the homework. They have actually the OS write code to do that. And there's obviously some tricky details, like you can't have used the virtual addresses in that OS code somehow, or at least you can't have TLB misses, or you'll have a problem because it will trigger itself again. But they've made this work, but this is generally not done anymore on modern systems, mostly because it's less convenient for out-of-order processors, performance-wise. But that's one reason. I guess the other reason is that it turned out that theoretically, this gives flexibility, but in practice, no one used it. Like, there was flexibility, and like you could have different page tables in theory because the OS wrote the code, but no one actually took advantage of that. Like, everyone was using the same page table format. So that's my 75 minutes. So I'm done. I can take a few questions after class. I have office hours this week. Otherwise.